Barbara counties, they reduced the vegetation to ash. So when record-breaking rains came yesterday, people held their breath, waiting for the mud to flow. But concrete barriers and sandbags kept small mud flows at bay. There were scattered reports of small rock slides in Santa Barbara County, where 120 homes burned, and a hillside slipping in South Orange County, but no serious mudslides. It wasn't nearly as bad as local officials had feared. Despite rainfall records in a few cities, an inch and a half or more in Burbank and Long Beach, for example. A spokesman for Santa Barbara County said that while this storm is over, their work is only beginning. It's just the start of the rainy season. For NPR News, I'm Steve Julian in Los Angeles.
And I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from Yahoo Search, providing features like Search Assist, which offers suggestions and related concepts as you type.
Support for today's broadcast comes from New Prairie Construction. New Prairie Construction specializes in all areas of home remodeling and are experienced in the use of green building technologies, including straw bale construction techniques. You can learn more on their website, newprairieconstruction.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from Bah Humbug Productions, presenting their second annual production of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol at Parkland College. Adaptation by Nick Schneider with original music by Tim Schirmer. Performances are December 5th through 21st. Ticket information and reservations at 351-2528.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. As we go about our daily lives, we leave behind us a trail of data. And there are people who are following that trail. They are looking at where we go and what we buy and what we read and who we talk to. The goal here is to develop a kind of a model of our behavior, and not just our behavior, but everybody's behavior. And the goal there, ultimately, at least for some people, is to manipulate our behavior to get us to do things maybe without our even noticing. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with journalist Stephen Baker about his new book, and it is entitled The Numerati, and it is a book that looks at the people who are doing this work, developing ways to crunch all of this kind of data, how they're doing it, and what they're doing with it, and perhaps also what that means to us. It's quite interesting, and I'm sure that you can find a copy out in the bookstore. Houghton Mifflin is the publisher. Stephen Baker has written for Business Week for more than 20 years. His writing has also appeared in other publications, including Wall Street Journal, L.A. Times, Boston Globe, Philadelphia Inquirer. He won an Overseas Press Club Award for his portrait of the rising Mexican auto industry. He is also co-author of Blogspotting.net, which the New York Times featured as one of 50 blogs to watch. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Mr. Baker, hello.
Hello there.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
I think that that probably some folks would appreciate just how much, you know, their data wake, just how much that is. And I expect maybe other people would say, well, they don't think that their data footprint is that big. And I guess what I wonder is, for those people, I mean, maybe there are some people who do have a pretty small data footprint, but I think for most people, would they be actually surprised how much there was?
I think people would be surprised. It's grown dramatically. For those of us who sort of live and participate in the modern world, it has grown dramatically. If you surf the internet, there are companies that are looking at the patterns of your clicks, which articles you read. If you, I don't know in Champaign-Urbana if you have automatic toll booths, but we do around New York, and they,
fortunately, we don't have that level of traffic yet.
That is something you maybe can look forward to. But if you use credit cards, that leaves a very clear path of what you buy, and that has for a long time. If you use a customer loyalty card, the supermarket, that tells the supermarket what you buy every week. So there are many, many ways in which we leave a data trail, and it's grown enormously ever since the dawn of the internet.
Mm-hmm. It seems that also, I guess, what I think is interesting is that if the idea is that someone is trying to profile us, for whatever reason, to assess our productivity, to try to see what we buy, to get us to buy something, you know, whatever. It seems interesting, though, that what some of the people have told you in this book is that, in fact, a lot of this stuff that we're talking about is actually junk, and that the art here is picking out what really matters, and that's where the people that you're talking about really come in.
Yeah, it's really a treasure hunt because there's so much of the stuff that the information that we emit as we go on the internet or buy things that really doesn't make much difference, and it doesn't distinguish us from everyone else. And if these numerati, these people that I talk about who try to figure out our patterns, if they focus on this junk, they waste a lot of time and they lose money and eventually they go out of business. So there's a real race among them to figure us out and to do it better than their competitors.
As you point out, data collection like this is not necessarily new, and certainly for marketing purposes, people have been trying to collect this information for a long time, things about us and who we are and where we live and what we buy, that sort of stuff. But is this really, are we talking about something that is fundamentally some steps further than that where we are now?
Yeah, I mean, traditionally, marketers have had things called focus groups where they bring in maybe 12 people and they show them a commercial or get them to eat some kind of food, and then they ask them about their experience, or they even monitor them with cameras and try to gauge their responses to things. What's happening now is that they can now monitor us in life and look at our behavior as we go through life, as we drive, as we work, as we surf the net, as we buy things online. And so they can look at our behavior, and they don't have to ask us questions. And they argue that gives them a much better look at us sort of unfiltered, because lots of times when we answer questions, we try to please whoever is asking the questions, try to satisfy them. And so, you know, there's this one company I looked at called Umbria that goes through millions of blog posts every day and automatically reads them. And then it can determine automatically the age of the blogger, the gender, and whether the blogger has a positive or negative impression about the latest Barack Obama commercial or the latest flavor of Coca-Cola or whatever they're being paid to look at. And so they're not always right, and I think it's important to mention this. They might be right 3 out of 4 times, but in the areas where these people really are taking off and making a lot of money, there are areas where they can afford to make mistakes, but statistically they still do okay. Like Google is a perfect example. They try to understand us, and sometimes they get us horribly wrong. Sometimes they give us an ad that makes us laugh. It's so irrelevant to what we're interested in. And yet they get it right enough of the time that they've turned into a multi-billion-dollar company that's basically run by the numerati.
Here, you know, I think you make an interesting point, and that is, for example, talking about someone who's combing through blogs looking
yes.
for useful information.
Yes.
And what that says is that I suppose with this business of data collection, some people look at it as something that's in a sense being stolen from us, and perhaps surreptitiously. In this, when you think about this, and perhaps you think about the other ways in which we are communicating in a public way, we're actually giving away a lot of information.
We are. We're giving away loads of information. And, you know, one of the things that people talk to me a lot about, and it really is a concern among a lot of readers, is the privacy implications of the numerati, of these people digging through our lives and trying to figure us out. And that frightens a lot of people and upsets them. But on the other hand, many of us are pouring our lives onto public networks, you know, with our photographs, our social networks, our blogs, and all the rest. And so I think we as a society are really torn between those of us who want to basically prance out there in public and those of us who are a little more reluctant to.
Also, it makes me think that there might be some people who would say, well, if you want to follow me around, you want to see what I do, you want to chart what I buy, you know, that's okay. Maybe I can live with that. But I want something for it. You know, you shouldn't be able to get this for free. At the very least, I should get something out of it.
Yeah, and that's my hope, that people who read this book will get a sense of the value of their data, and that I think what's going to happen is that companies are going to be offering tools and services where we can control our data more and perhaps have better control of it so that we can even sell our data or make deals, giving up our data in exchange for services. That's what we do a lot of times, like with the supermarket customer loyalty card. We're basically saying, okay, you can have my data. You can know what I buy every week, and in exchange for that, you get I get some discounts. Mm-hmm. But we don't really know what they're doing with that data. And I think in the future, they're going to have to be a little more clear about how they're using it and who they're sharing it with.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Stephen Baker. He's written for Business Week for more than 20 years and for other publications as well. And we're talking about some of what you will find in his recent book. The title is The Numerati. It's published by Houghton Mifflin. And it looks at the business of data gathering, how much information about us is available and collected, and what various people are doing to look at it, to sift it, to try to use it in various ways. It's an interesting book, so you might want to take a look at it. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The book has chapters that's divided into different sort of different life spheres. In the workplace, in our commercial behavior, in our political behavior, and so forth. And I think the place that I think people are most, maybe most aware, will readily think about where information is collected about them and what they do is in terms of what they buy, how they spend their money. And here I wonder, are we getting to the point where for retailers and for marketers, it's not just a kind of a retrospective thing. That is, well, they can collect information on what we have bought, but that they're looking for ways to actually use this information to get us to buy more stuff. Can they actually use that information in a way that can push us? And so it's not just a catalog of what we have bought, but it's a tool they can use to get us to buy more.
Yeah, they're looking at that. There's a lot of research, and I went to Accenture in Chicago, just up the road from you, where they're doing a lot of research into smart shopping carts, where basically they want you to walk into a store, swipe your customer loyalty card through a little slot on a little computer on the shopping cart, and it will give you your own path through the supermarket, showing you what it expects you to buy, what deals there are, and what other things you might be interested in, and then if you pick them up, you pass it by the computer, you automatically check out too, so it's quicker. Now a lot of people won't want that. A lot of people like the anonymity that we have in traditional supermarkets, and you know they might not go with that. And so these people have to make these services non-threatening and really, really easy to use if they're going to make it. But, you know, Microsoft and other companies are developing this technology. And what they want to do is figure out a different profile for each supermarket shopper so that they'll know whether you're on a diet or not. They'll know whether you keep kosher. And they'll give you things that they think you're really interested in and won't advertise all kinds of stuff to you that doesn't really suit your life.
Mm-hmm. And I guess here it goes back to the idea that to get people to accept that, that invasion, what some people would say is invasion of their privacy, you got to make it worth their while. People have to feel like there's enough of a trade-off there, so whatever they're giving up, they're getting something that they consider worth it, they're getting back. And that may indeed be in that sphere. It might be, well, we'll give you a special deal. We'll give you a coupon, we'll give you a price reduction, or we'll point you to where there is something in the store that we know you want, and we're actually going to you're going to save some money. So that's what you're getting and trading off to them, the fact that, yes, they do know an awful lot about you. So
and it sounds horrible to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And I'm sure a lot of the callers are going to think precisely that. The argument from the Numerati is that, you know, a half century ago when we went to the grocery store, there was a guy behind the counter who knew us, who knew what we like to eat, what we like to drink, who knew a lot about our lives and gave us customized service. And this is a way for us to get customized service automatically. You know, you can take that argument as you like, but that's the argument that they give.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I guess overall here, the point is that some people, particularly people who do this kind of work, would make the argument that this is not all bad. Yeah, there are privacy issues here, and that's there's a certainly important and worth discussing. But I'm sure there are people who would argue that you do get something in exchange, some better level of service, and that might provide you some satisfaction in your life. And maybe the idea is that overall, people are going to decide that what they gain outweighs what it is that they lose. At least I'm sure that's what the hope is.
Well, you know, that's what the hope is. And I think we're going to see these systems barging into our lives. I mean, we're already seeing them in a sense. I mean, if you go onto Netflix, they recommend movies for you. Amazon recommends books for you. You get a different Amazon experience than I do if you go onto the site. And that's just this is just the early steps of it. And these things, the economics behind this is so powerful because these people, for the first time in history, can compare you and me with 1 million or 10 million other people and try to figure out which data distinguishes you and me from everyone else. And so the economics is so convincing that they are going to change industries, and they are going to impose their science on us in all of these realms. And I think it's going to change our lives in a lot of ways. I would hope that we would have some level of control over it. But, you know, in certain areas like counterterrorism, we're not going to have a lot to say about it, perhaps.
Yeah. Well, it sounds as if maybe overall we may not have a lot to say about it. Is that the – I don't want to be too negative, but would you have to say to people whether you like this or not, that's simply the way that we're going?
You know, try making – come to New York City or maybe in Champaign. I don't know. But, you know, try making a self – try living without a cell phone these days. It's a lot harder than it was a decade ago. You know, it's harder to find pay phones. People expect to reach you on a cell phone. That's the part of the modern life that most of us have accepted in the last decade. And that little bit of the modern life has its conveniences, but it also tracks us everywhere we go and gives advertisers a real read on who we talk to, where we move, and they can use that to understand our behavior better. And so it is hard if you don't want to get off the grid to turn your back on a lot of these technologies that describe our behavior.
Well, and that's really, I think, a bottom line question that I'm sure a lot of people would have, and that is, even if you wanted to, can you opt out? It sounds like the answer is, well, not unless you're interested in taking on a very different kind of lifestyle than maybe we're becoming accustomed to.
Well, there are people who erase their cookies on the computer every day. Those are those little bits of software code that tell advertisers which sites we go to. And so every time they go on the computer, they have to re-enter their passwords and reestablish themselves and say, hey, this is me again. It makes your life more difficult. Some people are going to be willing to accept this higher degree of difficulty and some inconvenience in order to get a sense of more privacy. But I think most of us will tend to go along with it. What I found is that while a lot of us say we care about privacy, we often exchange privacy for savings or for increased convenience or the promise of safety. Think of the people that buy GM cars that has that OnStar navigation tracking on it. That tells a company exactly where you go everywhere in the car. It tells the company a lot about you. But you feel safer in the car, perhaps, if the car gets hijacked or if you have an accident or something like that. You like having that contact with the world. And so there's sort of a quid pro quo here.
And I think that, you know, that perhaps also some people would say, well, this business of someone collecting information about me, I might say, well, that's okay. I guess I can live with that. But what I want to do is have some control over who that information is exchanged with. I want to know if you're passing it around, and I want to know who you're passing it to, and I want to be able to have the opportunity to say, no, I don't want you to do that. And I think that that's a, you know, that's a vast sort of unexplored and difficult issue. I think people maybe think that they have that kind of control when they don't. I don't know if there really is a way to give people that opportunity every time someone wants to pass on some bit of information about you to somebody else, is it really realistic to think that every time they want to do that, they're going to call you or send you an email and say, oh, by the way, can we do this, so that you vote up or down?
But, David, I think that that is a place where consumer activists might really have a role, where they could perhaps develop lists of companies that abide by best practices. And the best practices are very clear privacy declarations, opt-in and not an opt-out, so they assume that you're not interested in this unless you choose to opt-in, and very clear messages about how they handle that data and who they share it with. And perhaps, you know, as we go forward, companies will want to get on the good list and be able to put some kind of a badge or star on their website or on their mailing, say, you know, and establish this level of trust with us. And I think we're going to be looking for companies that we can trust more and more in this area.
We're about midway through already this part of Focus 580, and let me again introduce our guest, Stephen Baker. He's written for Business Week for more than 20 years. His writing has also appeared in other publications, Wall Street Journal, LA Times, Boston Globe, Philadelphia Inquirer. He won an Overseas Press Club Award for his portrait of the rising Mexican auto industry. He's the co-author of Blogspotting.net, which the New York Times featured as one of the 50 blogs to watch. And the book that we're talking about here, if you'd like to look at it, is titled The Numerati, and it's published by Houghton Mifflin. Questions are welcome, certainly. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Another of the areas you look at, I think, is interesting, has to do with the workplace, and that you looked at someone who is trying to develop, a portrait of a very large workplace. I mean, we're talking about tens of thousands of people. And so that each person ends up being profiled individually. And I guess here the goal is to optimize the way that workforce is used and what people do and how you put people together and stuff like that. And I suppose some people, though, would worry that the downside is, well, it's just another way of the boss looking over our shoulder and monitoring our performance. And I suppose it is that, too.
That is. I mean, this is IBM we're talking about. And one of my first destinations as I was doing my reporting on this book was IBM, where they are going through the data of 50,000 of their consultants, and they're trying to build predictive mathematical models of these people. They're trying to incorporate all kinds of things about them, what their email patterns are, what the resume, their expertise, their experience, words they use in what they write. They're trying to understand these workers so that they can deploy them more efficiently. But I think one thing that's important is that when you're at work as an information worker, an office worker, and you're sitting at a PC, every keystroke, every mouse click that you do on that machine belongs to your boss. And your boss has the right, if he or she chooses, to monitor your behavior and to study it and compare it with those of your colleagues to find out whether you're productive, more productive, what your habits are. And, as an information worker myself, I'm not terribly comfortable with that, and I'm happy that I'm at an organization that seems a bit lax in this monitoring. But what IBM argues is that they can help people find other colleagues that they work well with, deploy them on teams where they will they'll be able to shine. So they have an argument for it. But basically what they're using is the same type of mathematical analysis that previously they used to put together machines. And before they had these systems to what they call optimize supply chains, all the pieces, the components that came together. And now they're trying to do that with people and optimize how people work. And a lot of people find that kind of scary. Yeah.
Let's talk with a caller. We have someone here in Urbana where we are, line number one. Hello.
Hi there. I'm interested in what you had to say about people opting out, erasing their cookies, not taking a customer loyalty card. I'm interested in how much of that you feel is important for you to do in your life. you know, how valuable is it, or how scary is the lack of it? And I'm going to have to just hang up and talk. Listen online. Thank you.
All right.
Well. Okay. Well, you know, I don't worry too much about this stuff. Maybe something bad will happen, and I'll start worrying about it. But I blog, so I blog, I Twitter, I use a customer loyalty card, I use Easy Pass on the Garden State Parkway, I use credit cards. I have a huge wake of data, and I don't worry about it. And as I say, maybe it'll come and bite me, and I'll take more care. But right now, I don't.
That's it. I wonder how many people. Well. I'm not sure how old you are, but how many people of our age, say over 50, can claim to blog and Twitter? I think it's really interesting is the big just in the use of these kinds of things. Yes, it does affect everybody if you live in the world, but how much of this breaks down according to age group and where in fact maybe your comfort level has something to do with how old you are.
Well, that could be. I'm 52, by the way.
Oh, okay.
And I feel like it. The blogging is a really important part of what I do. And by the way, I have a book blog that I would encourage your listeners to come to. It's called thenumerati.net, and I currently even have a puzzle up there. If people can answer it, they get a free signed copy of the book. But I find it's really important and for me, but also when I went to Umbria, this company that's looking at all these blog posts, I said, well, the blog posts must tell you a lot about young people, but they probably don't tell you about elderly people or even, middle-aged people. And they said, no, there are so many million bloggers that we can find hundreds of thousands of even, you know, elderly, senior citizen bloggers and all the rest. So they can do their analysis on what humanity is thinking about one thing or another and look at a whole lot of us just through the blogs.
Okay, let's talk next with someone else, also in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Hi, I'm a mathematician, and I just wish you'd have another name for this group of people that you're talking about, because most mathematicians have nothing to do with this.
Okay. Well, I mean, you mean not call them the numerati?
Yes.
Do you find that name distasteful or scary or something?
Yes, I think it casts an aspersion on mathematicians, people who work with numbers.
You know, that's the funniest thing because I thought it was a really cool name. And, you know, I work for Business Week and I write a lot of stories about tech, about people in technology. And people get so mad at the headline writers in my stories. I never use the word nerd or geek, but the headline writers do. And we get all this angry mail about nerds and geeks and stop calling us that. So I thought that what these people are doing is so powerful and really so cool. And that I thought they deserved a really neat name, and I'm sorry you don't like it.
I don't like it.
Okay.
Well, it does sort of make it sound like it's a secret society.
Well, yeah, it might make it sound like that, but it might also sound like a really powerful group of people, I think, which they are.
Uh-huh. Well, other questions and comments are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that's 800-222-9455. Are there other ways, and it seems to me whenever we have this kind of conversation about this kind of subject, it tends to drift negative just, I think, because there are concerns and reasonable concerns about the privacy issues, but there are some other, and I'm not necessarily, asking you to sell the idea so much as though, are there ways in which you could really make the argument that what we're talking about does have positive benefits?
Oh, many, many, many. See, I think it does. And, in many ways. I would like to, just for your last caller, I'd like mm-hmm. to just give an anecdote about one of these people who I think is doing terrific work. And one of the points is that if these people, who I call the numerati, if they have a breakthrough and understand a statistical pattern in one realm of science, they can often move it to another one that seems utterly unrelated and have breakthroughs elsewhere. And that gives them enormous power, and I find it incredibly exciting. One example of this. This guy at Microsoft named David Heckerman, he's an MD, and he's also a doctor in computer science. He and his team were working on building a spam filter. So they had to teach the machine what it was that distinguished spam, those bothersome advertising emails from the regular emails that we want to receive. And they had to go through all the rules, like what makes it a spam. But not only that, they had to look at how spammers would change the spam in order to get it past their defenses. So what they had to do was anticipate the mutation of the spam. And once they had an algorithm that could anticipate mutations, then they switched entirely and moved the entire team into the battle against HIV, the virus that leads to AIDS. Hmm. And so this team at Microsoft has moved into the AIDS and the battle against AIDS. They haven't come up with a vaccine yet, but they're important players in this battle. And I find that really inspiring. And I hope it gives a good name to the new Mirati, and so people don't have negative connotations.
You talked a little bit earlier about, say, just in the marketing sphere, for example, that people who are profiling us and trying to develop some picture of who we are and what we do and what we're interested in and perhaps what we might be likely to buy, that in spite of their best efforts, sometimes they could come up something that was just way, way wrong. I guess I'm just thinking about how this business of profiling people and putting people together doesn't always work. The story I'm thinking about is when you were looking at one of these matching services that's supposed to match, find you your ideal mate. And so you went in there and you signed up and you did the thing and you got your wife to do the same thing. And
she was very reluctant about it, but she finally agreed.
So she did, and presumably you're a good match, and one of the things you were just wanting to find out was, well, would this service match you and your wife? I mean, would you or she come up on your list of potential good matches? And the answer is no, it didn't.
It didn't, but it was because I made a mistake. I finally realized, because they were setting up my wife with all these people who lived very far from us on the far, in New York City. I live in New Jersey, and in New York City they were setting her up with people, and I was right there in Montclair, New Jersey, and they weren't lining her up with me. So I went and I looked, and I found out that I had made one small error in my data entry, and that was separating me from my wife. I had inadvertently excluded any women older than me, which was I'm still not forgiven for that yet. But, but when I fixed that, they did line me up with my wife. But I have to say that I think love is a real stretch goal for the new Mirati. I think, I think where they can, maybe they can have some successes, but I think it's pretty hard to untangle all the human complexity that leads one person to love another. But, where they really can do some interesting things, I think, is in medicine. Mm-hmm. They can – this one experiment that I went and saw on Intel, they've wired the homes of elderly people who have agreed to participate in this with lots of sensors. And they're trying to measure everything that they can in these people's lives, their footsteps and how they distribute their weight and the strength of their voice and how long it takes them to recognize a known voice in the phone. And then when they see that they establish what they call baselines for all of those behaviors, and when they see a deviation from those baselines, then they can try to come to some conclusions about what's happening with these people, if they're coming down with some disease, if they're at risk of falling, things like that. I know it sounds very intrusive, but the opportunities for us to monitor ourselves and get a read on what we could be coming down with could really change the whole nature of healthcare, I think.
Well, and that is something that you, right on the face of it, you'd think that for some people that would have great appeal. You have an elderly relative, a parent, someone like that, they're living on their own, and you can't always be there all the time. Something that would try to keep an eye on them, that would actually give you useful information, that would tell you how they were doing at any moment, and then also give you some longitudinal data so that you could say, well, how are they doing this week, and how were they doing a month ago, and how were they doing 6 months ago? You think, well, actually, that could be very useful, and you could also imagine downsides for it, but maybe that's the thing with anything. Yeah, it's got both positives and negatives, and you've got to decide, do the positives outweigh the negatives?
Well, what I think is going to happen, really, is I think middle-aged people are going to impose these systems on the people that they feel responsible for, their elderly parents and grandparents and their children. And then when they see benefits, they might start using these systems to monitor themselves because, you know, it might alert you that you have the risk of a heart attack or a stroke. That's the kind of information that is useful to us. Or, but one other thing, sometimes the data can be wrong, too. Mm-hmm. Like they had this one in the Intel program, they had this one woman who was being weighed every night in bed. They had a scale attached to her bed, and they noticed, and that's very important if you have congestive heart failure. If you gain a lot of weight quickly, it means you're taking on fluids and you're in real danger. So it's something that you do want to keep an eye on. But one night, this woman gained 8 pounds, and it turned out her dog had jumped on her bed.
Well, the thing that I think about is, again, it's the questions about once you're able to collect that kind of information, and it could be certainly very useful, I find myself thinking about then what happens to that information, and do we say that automatically it should link to somehow we should include something in there that will determine whether there's an emergency, and will that automatically link to 911? Are we going to automatically provide this information to our physicians, to the insurance companies and to the people that manufacture prescription medicines to say, hey, here's a person here who maybe could use this medicine we've got. And there, again, it gets us back to this issue of how easily and how widely available is that information, who's going to get access, and how much control are we going to have over who gets access.
Well, not only that, but I mean, imagine if your insurance company calls you up and says, hey, we'll give you a 30% discount on your health insurance if you let us put some monitors in your house. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people would say yes because maybe it'll tell them that they're getting a disease and help save their lives, and they'd always like to save 30%. But then what happens if the insurance company finds that you're living your patterns are riskier? Can they raise the rates? I mean, I think we're going to be facing these kinds of issues as we're monitored more and more, and our behavior is understood by these automatic machines that are programmed by the people I call the numerati.
I'm starting to get more and more scared about this. I don't know. It sounds to me like the benefits are starting to wear off. I'm starting to get a little bit more concerned just about the ability to gather data and accumulate that, and who's going to get it and what they're going to do with it.
Well, you know what, David? This thing is not going to slow down anytime soon, because as we buy more things and surround ourselves with more data, we produce more. I mean, surround ourselves with more electronics, we produce more and more data. You know, right now, many of us have a cell phone. Maybe we'd like at some point to get something like an iPhone. Well, the iPhone gives a lot more detail on our behavior because it looks at where are you when you look at that web page. You know, what music do you listen to when you're in this place or that place? It adds a whole level of your movement, your day-to-day activities that they can start studying. And the surveillance cameras that are going up, I mean, we are surrounding ourselves with all kinds of technology that monitors our behavior.
Yeah. And I guess I wonder again, say with the iPhone example, whether you think that it's that people who have them know that, are conscious of that, and don't care, or maybe they're actually not conscious of that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's this one company that I've talked to called Sense Networks, and they have this software that goes into cell phones that beams the message up to computers so that Sense Networks can look at the movement patterns of all of its subscribers in a city like San Francisco or New York. And you can see these patterns of people, and they, based on their patterns, they have divided people into what they call tribes. And these tribes tend to live in certain neighborhoods and go to certain nightclubs and hang out on these corners and that corners at certain times of the day or the night. And now, you know, then they give that information to advertisers so that advertisers can put their billboards in the path of these tribes that move this way and that. And so the amount of data is just going to explode.
Yeah, well, and that sort of business of trying to profile people, developing databases that are attached to people's zip codes, for example, that said, okay, these people live in this place, and saying things like, if you tell me your zip code, I can tell you maybe what kind of car that you drive, and you know whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, you know, those sorts of things. People have been doing that for a while now. It seems that this is just we're bumping this up several orders of magnitude. Not only the information that can be accumulated, but then if somebody wants to, what they can do with it, particularly in terms of direct marketing.
Well, that's true, because traditionally, they've had to look at us in marketers or politicians, for example, have had to look at us in terms of the big groups that we belong to. They look at, you know, white, black, Latino, urban, rural, rich, poor, union members, gun owners, things like that. It's extremely crude, and they've had to say, well, we know that all these people don't really have the same views, but we know that quite a few of them do, and so we're going to give them all the same advertisement. And it's, as I say, it's extremely crude. What they're doing now is looking at ways to differentiate us so that even though our next-door neighbor drives the same kind of car that we do, has approximately the same kind of income, and the same type of, let's say, split-level house, there's something that makes that person very different, and perhaps that person fits into a different political tribe than you or I do, and is going to get a different treatment in whether it's politics or the supermarket. They're finding ways to distinguish us and cherry pick certain ones of us and give us special treatment.
Stephen Baker's our guest. He writes for Business Week. His book is The New Marathi, published by Houghton Mifflin, out now. We have a caller and would welcome others. About 10 minutes left in the show. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next is Bloomington, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thank you for very informative. I'm sorry that I missed part of it. My question may have been answered. I guess this is the same sort of thing that's being used to analyze our library records and if so, the part that is frightening to me is the human that comes in there and analyzes this stuff, because they're so subject to error and their own personal bias.
That's a really good point. I think what you're referring to is the national security sort of anti-terrorism.
Yes.
People looking through library records.
And other data.
And other data, trying to figure out who among us might be a terrorist.
Right.
And that is, and David, you know, we're talking about scary. That, mm-hmm. for me, is mm-hmm. the scariest part of the book, because, you know, the people at the National Security Agency, they have a huge team of mathematicians and enormous amounts of data, much of it gathered in controversial ways, you know, our internet traffic and our telephone calls. And they are mining through this data, looking for patterns that they think can ferret out terrorists among us. The trouble is that while people in the supermarkets understand our patterns very well as buyers of Cheerios or hamburger, because we do it every week and millions of us do it, the patterns of terrorists are much, much harder to discern. And this is because we have been lucky not to have had thousands or millions of terrorist attacks in this country. There have been very, very few, and so we don't know the patterns of terrorists very well. And so that leads to what this caller brings up. It leads to people making assumptions about what they think terrorist behavior might be, and that is a really dangerous thing because their judgment might be flawed. There was one example that I heard about that I didn't include in the book because I couldn't document it, but there was a report that one FBI agent in the Bay Area wanted to look at hummus consumption in San Francisco, thinking that a spike in hummus consumption might signal a terrorist activity in a certain neighborhood in San Francisco. Now, I would imagine you have lots of hummus in Champaign-Urbana, and it might be associated more with yoga behavior than terrorist behavior. Who knows?
Yeah.
But those sorts of silly assumptions could lie at the base of an analysis that comes out and it is emitted as mathematical or scientific analysis, but there's a stupidity at its very basis, and that's very dangerous.
And you say that doesn't frighten you, or it does?
That does.
Yeah.
I think the most frightening thing about this is the power that a police state could have.
Exactly.
And in the wrong hands. And, you know, this isn't just in the United States. This is happening all over the world. And so I guess I hope and trust that people in the United States will use our data wisely. But I'm not sure about that.
Yeah.
But I'm really worried about in China and other countries, how are they going to use this?
Yeah. Oh, yes, because it would be dispersed.
Yeah.
Just beyond. Well, you know, I was thinking, I took out several books on women in Middle Eastern countries, and you know, I thought, oh my gosh, if some yahoo get hold of this and think, what would they think? And you know, humans are humans, and we're not all experts, and not all experts get hired either by these analysts are not all experts. That's what I said.
Well, that's true. You know, one thing that when I tell people about what the Numerati are doing and looking at our grocery records and all the rest, people think of these experts looking at our behavior one by one and perhaps taking note that we're buying fattening food or you know, various paraphernalia that we'd be ashamed of or things like that. These are machines doing it for the most part. And so they're going through each one of us in a tiny fraction of a second. And so if it's any comfort, it isn't humans for the most part looking at our behavior. It's the machines that humans have programmed.
I want to thank the caller. We just have a couple of minutes left. I want to get one more caller, at least here back, going back to Urbana in line one. Hello.
Hi.
Yeah.
I had a question. It sort of brings to mind talking about the library reference, if you have any anecdotes about people trying to jam this sort of thing. I remember after 9/11, there was sort of an internet thing where you sort of would send out an email, or groups of people would send out an email, and they would have all these sort of, you know, words that were supposed to be flagged by the system, and in order, and they did this on specific days to try to like sort of throw a wrench into the system. Could you speak to something of that, and I'll take my answer off the
okay.
line.
You know, I don't have specific examples of people conspiring in groups to fool these systems or to hack them. But one thing that all of these people, all these numerati have to take into account is that we as humans try to game any system that we think controls us. We try to turn it to our own advantage. That's just what we do, and that's how our brains work. And so... One of the things that we're going to have to do in the future is figure out the machines that are interpreting us and then do what we can do to satisfy their demands. We already do this with Google. You know, if you have a web page, you hire a consultant to tweak your web page so that Google likes it and gives it a good page rank. And that way you show up, your company shows up in the first page of search results. That's a crucial thing for companies. Going forward, we are going to have to understand the systems that are looking at us as workers and shoppers and voters and even dating services, and give the machine what it wants so that we show up high on results and it does right by us. And that's just it. To reach other humans, we have to satisfy the machines.
We're coming down to the point where we have a couple of minutes left. You know, I find myself going back to the example about the matchmaker services and
mm-hmm.
your comment that this is one area that's really difficult. And I suppose it just says something about human beings being quirky and complex. And maybe you can draw some small consolation from the idea that there are limits to how quantifiable we are. And that makes me think that, you know, those people who would say that the problem here is that this reduces us, this quantification reduces us, I suppose, and maybe I'm being overly optimistic, that you can also look at this in another way and say, well, actually what it tells you is how complex we are. and that they really don't want to put us into big groups. They want to establish us all as individuals.
They want to look at us as individuals. They get us wrong a certain percentage of the time, because where they thrive are areas where they look at 1,000 of us and they guess right on 750. And with that 750, they guess right. They do well. They make a lot of money, but they don't get. But it's really hard with the individual, and that's why terrorism is very hard, and that's why love is very hard. They cannot master the complexity of an individual human.
Now, I suppose, though, there are people who would say, "Well, now give me enough data.
give me the opportunity to get
enough data, and I can do it."
These are the very, very early days. This is something that is going to be going on for the next, decades and decades. And they learn a little by little, but they improve, and they're going to get better and better at understanding us and giving us customized services. And hopefully, we'll get better at controlling the invasions in our lives.
And what now for people who do this kind of work? What are there still some holy grails here? Some things that they cannot do that they really want to be able to do, or does it have to do with accumulate just the thought that if I could accumulate enough data, I could do anything?
Well, there's some really basic things that they've been working on in artificial intelligence laboratories for decades and decades, and they still haven't mastered. One thing is facial recognition. If they could recognize our faces as we go through the world, then they could basically point a camera at a stadium, take a picture of 20,000 people, and then have the data run out on everybody who's at the stadium. That is something that the National Security Agency, of course, would love to be able to do. They'd like to take a picture of everybody in a crowded cafe in Baghdad and just run the data. It's really hard to figure out the faces, though, because we grow beards, we chew things, we turn, we gain weight, we get older. So that's one of the holy grails.
Hmm. On balance, did you come out of this thinking that it's cool and scary, or is it more cool than scary?
For me, it's more cool than scary. I really enjoyed this book. I thought that everybody, I profiled these various numerati who are trying to understand us as shoppers and voters and lovers and patients, and I thought each one of them was dedicated to trying to make our lives better. I didn't think these were people working in bad faith. It can be used that way. These are very powerful tools, but I am optimistic about it. I think it could make our lives better and healthier in a lot of ways.
Well, folks who are listening can read about it and decide that for themselves or think about that. The book we're talking about is The Numerati, published by Houghton Mifflin, by our guest Stephen Baker. He writes for Business Week. And thanks very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for Focus 580 comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Institute has now established the Center for Men and Masculinity, aimed at research, clinical services, and education about boys and men. Information at menandmasculinity.com.
This is David Inge. We're planning another cooking show and looking for hearty chili, soup, and stew recipes. Send your recipe by January 2nd to Chili, Soups, and Stews, WILL-TV, 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. We'll put together a cookbook and choose several chefs to join Doyle Moore and me for a live cooking special in March. Learn more at WILL.illinois.edu.
You're listening to AM 580. Thank you for making us a part of your Thanksgiving holiday. The forecast today, sunny, highs in the lower 50s. Tonight, partly cloudy, lows around 30. Friday, mostly sunny, highs in the upper 40s. Friday night, partly cloudy, lows in the upper 20s. Saturday, mostly sunny, highs in the lower 40s. Saturday night and Sunday, partly cloudy with a 30% chance of snow showers, lows in the upper 20s.
Programs on WILL AM are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. Coming in January, there will be three opportunities to enjoy the Russian National Ballet Theater performing the timeless story, Sleeping Beauty. More information is at KrannertCenter.com.
You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.